Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. As you may have heard, we have a new mayor here in New York. Now, our old mayor, Mike Bloomberg, was not shy about spreading the wealth, both the city's and his own, among arts and cultural organizations. With Bill de Blasio taking over, the community of artists, musicians, museum curators, theater companies, and the like, are wondering what's in store for them. We'll attempt to read those tea leaves in just a moment. We've also got a visit from filmmaker Bill Morrison, whose new movie, The Great Flood, is actually built of archival footage of the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. That flood was the worst in American history, and it had a huge impact on our culture. We'll trace that impact through eight decades of music, from Memphis Minnie to Bill Frisell. And our live band today is Lakeisha Benjamin's Soul Squad. Her blend of jazz and soul and funk is... well, it's so catchy, we just couldn't wait to share it with you. So here's Jump and Shout from Lakeisha Benjamin and Soul Squad, live on Soundcheck.
Your ass out my world and move on soon, 'cause you make me
That's Lakeisha Benjamin and Soul Squad with Jump and Shout, live in the Soundcheck studio. We'll talk with Lakeisha and hear some more music from the band in just a bit. But right now, time to talk about New York's new mayor. Last week, Bill de Blasio was sworn in as the 109th mayor of New York City. And now the local arts community is wondering what exactly this new mayor's tenure will bring. After all, this is a group that, in general, did pretty well under former mayor Michael Bloomberg. Joining me is Jennifer Maloney. She's arts reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've written about Bloomberg's tenure and his support for the arts a couple of times, and the upshot seems to be that de Blasio has a tough act to follow.
That's what a lot in the arts community say. Bloomberg oversaw more than $2 billion of capital spending on construction projects and renovation projects that transformed the buildings, the physical footprint of arts institutions across the city. Nearly every major arts institution in New York was touched in some way. And so a lot of watching de Blasio to see, you know, will he have as strong a commitment to the arts?
Right. Will he have the same budget that Mayor Bloomberg had? That's one question. Mm-hmm. We already know the answer to the other question, which is, does he have the personal deep pockets that Mayor Bloomberg had? Because that's the other part of this story, isn't it?
Right. And de Blasio has said, look, you know, I'm not a billionaire, but I care about the arts. I acknowledge that they contribute to tourism. They contribute to economic development. And he's made a couple of commitments that would be a departure from the Bloomberg years.
Really?
One thing he has committed is to implement arts instruction in every school across the city within 4 years, which would be a departure from the Bloomberg administration. He's also said that
Now, how is that? I mean, there was money set aside for arts education in the schools, but this was a somewhat controversial move on former Mayor Bloomberg's part, right?
It was. Under Giuliani, arts money was set aside. It was earmarked specifically for arts instruction in schools. Bloomberg changed that, and he gave principals the discretion to use it however they liked. Mm-hmm. So that meant that you didn't have arts in every school. If the principal wanted to spend it on extra math tutors, he or she could.
Right. Although in your article, you point out that, in fact, the level of arts in the schools did go up, even with this kind of discretionary spending.
What the Bloomberg administration pointed to was that they brought in a number of independent arts groups, artists, people like, you know, the Metropolitan Opera and Lincoln Center and Jazz at Lincoln Center all have programs that work inside schools.
Right.
So they encouraged a lot of partnerships, but they don't have arts instruction in every school, and that's something de Blasio wants to change.
All right. We're speaking with Jennifer Maloney, arts reporter for the Wall Street Journal, about changes in what the New York arts community can expect now that we have a new mayor in town for the first time in 12 years. What were some of the projects that we can sort of directly attribute to Mayor Bloomberg?
One really big project, which will open in 2015, is the new Whitney Museum in the Meatpacking District. So it's moving downtown. It has this brand new building that's just getting finished now that will anchor the south end of the High Line, the mm-hmm. elevated park along the west side of Manhattan. Another project that didn't start under the Bloomberg years, but certainly was helped by the Bloomberg administration, was the massive renovation of the Lincoln Center campus.
Right.
A more than $1 billion project that got more than $200 million from the city.
So in 2009, Alice Tully Hall reopened after a $159 million renovation. And actually, New York Public Radio was there on opening night. Here's a bit of that performance from February 22nd, 2009.
Thank you.
music, Sephardic music as it happens, from Jordi Savall and his band Hesperion 21, a great early music group from Europe that helped to reopen Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center on the evening of February 22, 2009. It reopened during Mayor Bloomberg's tenure with a lot of city support, as Jennifer Maloney of the Wall Street Journal was just telling us. In addition to Lincoln Center, BAM also got a major renovation. That, too, had been in the works when he took office, but he was very supportive of that. You mentioned the Whitney at the south end of the High Line. There's something at the north end of the High Line as well, right?
And this is going to be another signature part of Bloomberg's legacy. This is a new arts institution that was incubated by the Bloomberg administration, really conceived by them, to be the cultural centerpiece of the Hudson Yards development over the rail yards at the west side of Manhattan. And this would be an exhibition space, a flexible exhibition space called Culture Shed, that is still being planned. The Bloomberg administration formed a new nonprofit, and Mayor Bloomberg, former Mayor Bloomberg, appointed people to run this new nonprofit. And he controversially allocated a lot of city funding to help build this thing when it does get built. Over the summer, he was criticized for allocating $50 million in city capital funds. And then right before he left office, he gave it another $25
million. Mm-hmm. So basically creating a whole new kind of swath of arts and cultural stuff.
Absolutely.
On the west side of Manhattan.
So the elevated High Line Park would then become this cultural corridor stretching from the Hudson Yards development at 34th Street all the way down through the Gallery District of Chelsea to the Whitney Museum in the Meatpacking District.
Now, why was it controversial that, you know, he's giving capital money to build something that could, in fact, anchor, as you say, a whole corridor of additional culture, which we know is one of the engines that drives our economy?
Well, certainly there are a lot of arts leaders in the city who support the idea of Culture Shed. But there were some arts groups who said, hey, we could use that money. Why don't you divert some of that money to existing cultural organizations rather than giving it to something that hasn't even, you know, been built yet?
Now, does Mayor Bill de Blasio come into office with any kind of track record that we can sort of extrapolate from?
He does. As a councilman, he allocated funding to a number of cultural organizations, both in Brooklyn, where he represented his district, and outside of Brooklyn. And most of that money was focusing on arts education. So that's a clear indication of where his heart is.
Mm-hmm.
They went to institutions large and small. They went to BAM. They went to the Brooklyn Museum. They went to the struggling South Street Seaport Museum, which will be another thing that his administration will have to grapple with because its future is very much in the air at the moment.
Right. And the Bloomberg administration had to kind of deal with that as well in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy and all of that. So with Bill de Blasio's commitment to some Brooklyn-centric stuff, that certainly made sense when he was representing that. And now he's got the whole city to take care of. What have you heard in your reporting from various arts administrators? And, you know, is there worry that the pot is suddenly not as full as it once was?
Well, certainly they're waiting with bated breath to hear how much money he allocates both for programming needs and also for capital projects. And Mayor de Blasio, during his campaign, wouldn't say exactly.
Mm-hmm.
He said, look, we're going to have to wait and see how the budget plays out, what the fiscal constraints are. He wouldn't commit to spending as much as former Mayor Bloomberg did. He did say that he wants to support smaller and grassroots cultural organizations more. And that was one of the sort of milder criticisms of former Mayor Bloomberg, that not enough money went to smaller organizations. Although they did shift over the years, they did shift money from the bigger ones to the smaller ones.
Mm-hmm. So Bill de Blasio has, you know, gotten a lot of encouragement and support from musicians, from artists, and from the Musicians Union and from the Stagehands Union, from groups of people who did not have the best relationship, shall we say, with the Bloomberg administration.
Right. He has strong union support, including a lot of musicians' unions and artists' unions. And they support him for his commitment to arts education, but also for his commitment to helping create affordable housing and reducing the income gap. for a lot of artists in New York City, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to live in New York City. It's a very expensive place to live. And so they support him for his commitment to try to make it easier as a working artist.
And in fact, at the inauguration last week, at Bill de Blasio's mayoral inauguration, the Broadway actress and singer Patina Miller performed this song. Broadway actress and singer Patina Miller doing John Lennon's Imagine at City Hall last week during Bill de Blasio's inauguration. We're speaking with Jennifer Maloney, arts reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and talking about what the arts community might expect from the new mayor administration. One thing they can expect is there's an advocate for the arts right there in City Hall, right there in Gracie Mansion.
In Gracie Mansion. Yes. Mayor de Blasio's wife, Shirlane McRae, is a writer and a poet. And she is really involved in projects to get kids into the spoken word and poetry. She sits on the board of the Feminist Press. And she's been a strong advocate. She and her husband have been a strong advocate for this small museum in Brooklyn called the Museum of Contemporary African Diasporan Arts. So smaller arts organizations are looking to her and to him for support moving forward.
So one final question. Reading your articles, the assumption on the part of many administrators seems to be that when Mayor Bloomberg sets sail into the sunset, his money goes with him. I mean, he's still going to be here, right? Will his personal fortune be leaving, you know, as he leaves Gracie Mansion and City Hall?
Well,
not that he ever lived at Gracie Mansion, but you know what I mean.
It is a question on people's minds. As mayor and as a philanthropist, he supported arts institutions in New York. Now, it's possible that his giving, his personal giving, may not be focused solely on New York, but it might be spread a little more broadly. And so you might not see as much money going to New York arts institutions. At least that is the worry.
All right. We've been speaking with Jennifer Maloney, arts reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who's been writing a lot on the mayors, past and present, and their support of the arts. Jennifer, Happy New Year. Thank you for being with us.
Happy New Year. Thanks so much.
More from the artist you heard at the top of the show, sax player and bandleader Lakeisha Benjamin, and later, music and film inspired by the Great Flood of 1927. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sax player and native New Yorker Lakeisha Benjamin started out playing with the legendary jazz trumpeter Clark Terry in his big band, but she's also made a name for herself as a sidewoman to artists like Stevie Wonder and Alicia Keys, and as a composer and bandleader of her own group. She and her band Soul Squad put out a debut album in 2012 called Retox, and today they're here with me in the studio to play a new song. Here's Lakeisha Benjamin and Soul Squad with a tune called Marcus Miller, live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
That is Lakeisha Benjamin and the band Soul Squad live on Soundcheck with a song called Marcus Miller, featuring Lakeisha playing the alto sax, Vicky Natale on vocals, Calvin Brown playing the keyboard, Joe Blacks behind our drum kit, and David Cutler playing the bass. So is David in the role of Marcus Miller, the jazz bassist here?
Technically he is.
Now, this is a new song.
Yes.
From the next record that'll be yes. out later this year. The last record, called Retox, also had a song that was named after a musician. And in
yes.
that case, it was Maceo.
Yes.
Named after Maceo Parker. So is this something that you've been known to do from time to time, write songs about favorite musicians?
Yeah, well, technically, I'm inspired by a lot of, I say, old school funk musicians. Not that Marcus Miller is so old school, but I feel like I need to pay them some type of honor, you know?
Right, right. Now, there's words here. Who wrote the words?
I wrote the words.
But so, you don't sing them?
No.
Why?
I think that might be best.
Were you ever ever tempted to try?
It happens because I have to sing her the words for her to get it.
But, right.
You know? It's a very private process.
So discretion being the better part of valor, you
yeah.
just stick to the sax.
Yeah.
So it's interesting you mention, you know, Maceo Parker and sort of classic funk musicians. I mean, Maceo has had a long career and,
yes.
you know, still going, you know, having worked with De La Soul and Prince and
yeah.
people like that. But you think of him as the James Brown guy, right? Or the P-Funk guy.
I think of him as, when it comes to funky saxophone, that's your guy.
Yeah. Was he the poster on the bedroom wall when you were growing up?
Well, growing up, the poster on the wall was John Coltrane.
Really?
Yes, that's the poster on the wall. And I went through Bird phase, a Cannonball phase, Jackie McLean, huge phase, Eddie Harris, you know, Charlie Rouse. But I slowly
So really,
evolved.
Seriously old school.
Yeah.
How did that happen? I mean, did you get that from your parents?
No, my parents listened to more, I think, traditional 90s music, like De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, you know, Biggie. Stuff like that. But I think when you start to get into jazz and you really have to get to the language of the music,
mm-hmm.
you have no choice but to go back if you want to go forward.
So what did your mom think? She's listening to Biggie Smalls and the kid in the bedroom is listening to Jackie McLean and John Coltrane and stuff.
I can tell you exactly what she did. She would cut it off and say, get that old time stuff out of here. And I was banished to the basement to play Duke Ellington.
And when you first brought a sax into the house, was that a happy day for,
actually,
for mom?
Actually, I brought it home and I started playing it and she took the mouthpiece off and said, not in this house. And the next day I went and told the music teacher and he came back and convinced her to let me start.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the alto saxophone tone
yeah.
takes a long time to develop.
So was that what you started with, the alto?
I started with the recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately they were going to move me the trombone or something and I said, I want to play the sax. And they said, oh, we have a tenor available. I said, I'm not interested in that.
Really?
Yeah, I've always kind of
How old were you?
I was 10 at the time.
10 years old, and you already know that the tenor sax is not your instrument.
Well, it could be seen as like I was like very in touch with my career, or it could be seen as it was the size of me.
Right.
And I was like, no way. I'm not going to take that home.
And what about now? Do you play all of them?
Yeah,
soprano,
I play all
alto,
them.
Tenor, baritone?
I mean, yeah, now I play all of them, but my voice, I feel like, is on the alto, but it's the same for each one.
Yeah. So into jazz, also into funk, so no surprise then that Retox sort of
yeah.
blends those two things. When the new album comes out later this year, will it be kind of in that vein?
It's definitely going to be extremely funky, but I do have some moments where I will definitely pay tribute to some jazz.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the song we're going to hear next, Dreams, this is one of the ones, this is from Retox.
This is from Retox, yes.
This has a kind of a neat rhythm going through it. Where does that come from?
Actually, I was listening to a D'Angelo album one day, and it kind of was doing that drone thing seeping in,
uh-huh.
and it made me just think of, whoa, it'd be nice to make a song that had this kind of drone thing happen. I'm not really into brushes.
Right.
I've never been into the jazz brushes unless it's an up-tempo song. So mallets, you know, spoke to me.
Okay. So that's what's happening here.
That's what's happening.
Let's hear the song.
Okay.
Lakeisha Benjamin and Soul Squad playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. They are playing at the Zinc Bar on Saturday, January 11th at 11:30 p.m. It is part of the annual Winter Jazz Fest here in New York. And obviously playing for us in the Soundcheck studio, this song is called Dreams. Lakeisha Benjamin and Soul Squad playing a song called Dreams. You'll find that on their 2012 CD called Retox. And you'll find Lakeisha Benjamin and Soul Squad playing at the Zinc Bar on Saturday night, January 11th. A late show, 11:30 p.m. It is part of the annual Winter Jazz Fest here in New York City. But Lakeisha and the band are taking some time to play for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. So now, we were talking before about some of the, you know, the names on your wall of fame, you know, the Coltranes and Maceo Parkers and Marcus Miller and people like that. Any women? I mean, as a sax player and a band leader, did you have women role models that you could look up to?
You mean more so musically listening to or maybe bringing me up?
Well, as a sax player, you know, were you a fan of, say, Jane Ira Bloom? Or as a band leader?
Jane Ira Bloom was actually my teacher at the New School.
No way.
Yeah, so that did actually help a lot.
Oh, okay.
But I've always been a big Alice Coltrane fan.
Well, of course, her instrument was the harp.
Yeah. Well, the piano. She has a lot of
and
stuff
piano.
On piano.
Yeah.
She's into a lot of good things. But I've been very big on female vocals. I mean, they move me more than male vocals. So Nancy Wilson, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, that's another big one for me. I mean, the classics.
What about band leaders? You know, that's still a rarity, isn't it?
It is a rarity.
Yeah. Well, Soul Squad has Lakeisha Benjamin at the helm, which hasn't stopped you, Lakeisha, from still doing kind of side projects, you know, working for other people. And so I have to ask you about a pet peeve that you tweeted about recently. You apparently played some pop artist gig, without mentioning any names, where they didn't turn the horn mics on?
Oh, yes.
What was that?
That's pop music. You know, I've definitely played shows on mute the whole time, like at the Garden. So
you're blowing your brains out and no one hears it.
Yes, and I really don't like that.
Well, I can see why that would be a pet peeve.
Yes.
So. Nothing to worry about with the Zinc Bar. You will be heard by all and sundry,
yes.
I'm sure. And then once Winter Jazz Fest ends, you're out on the road?
Yeah, I'm going out with James Blood Omer. We're doing a three-week Europe tour.
Great.
So it should be fun.
Lakeisha Benjamin and Soul Squad play at the Zinc Bar on Saturday night, January 11th, at 11:30 p.m. It is part of the annual Winter Jazz Fest. The album Retox came out in 2012, but Lakeisha and Soul Squad have a new one later this year?
I would say September. That's
September.
The slated date.
All right. Lakeisha, it's been great having you in the band here.
Thanks very much.
Coming up, the historic natural disaster that inspired a wealth of music and a new documentary drawn from archival footage. Filmmaker Bill Morrison joins us to talk about the Great Flood of 1927. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Led Zeppelin's famous and often sampled version of When the Levee Breaks got a new life after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans back in 2005. But the original song goes back to another earlier disaster, the Great Flood of 1927, when the Mississippi River overflowed its banks and affected 10 states.
If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And the water gonna come, I have no place to stay. Well, all last night I sat on the levee and moaned.
When Memphis Minnie and Kansas Joe McCoy recorded the first version of the song, it was 1929, and the fallout from the Great Flood was still recent history. But the Great Flood was not just the most destructive river flood America's ever seen.
It was a pivotal moment in American culture and changed the course of American music. Now, filmmaker Bill Morrison is presenting his new silent movie, The Great Flood, culled from archival footage from 1927 and silent except for a brilliant new score by guitarist Bill Frisell. Bill Morrison, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks so much, John.
Am I overstating the case? Did this flood really kind of change the course of music history?
It changed the course of American history, I'd say, you know, culturally, politically, the way that we treated rivers. And of course, the Great Migration was an ongoing event, and this was something that promoted it and made it.
The Great Migration of African Americans up the Mississippi to parts of the northern United States.
Specifically, northern urban centers.
Right.
It's been going on. Arguably since the Civil War, and then there was a big spike at World War I, and this was yet another one.
Mm-hmm. So you had the sounds of Southern music being brought to places that hadn't heard it before.
You had Delta blues guitarists coming just as the electric guitar was starting to converge upon the states. And so you had, you could think of it as people needed to be heard over the sounds of the city, and they would plug in, and the music changed. So,
So Bill Frisell, who worked with you on this film, The Great Flood, he's just the latest in a long line of Americans responding to this particular event in April of 1927. Where does that start? Where do we first hear musicians responding to The Great Flood?
Well, as you said, one of the earliest is Memphis Minnie, and the most often quoted. I think Bessie Smith recorded something in 1926, and that was the Cumberland River. And, you know, flooding happened in the east and throughout the south in the winter before, and culminating in 1927, where just not enough water drained off so that you had this convergence.
So with Bessie Smith's Backwater Blues, she had already written this but everybody assumes that, you know, I mean, it was unfortunate but perfect timing because it sort of hit the
it was the same
the
flood,
charts
if you will.
So this is Bessie Smith, recorded in 1927, and her song Backwater Blues.
When it rained 5 days in the sky turned dark and when it rained 5 days and the sky turned dark as night, then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night. I woke up this morning, can't even get out of my cell. There's enough trouble to make a poor girl wonder where she wanna go. Then they roll a little boat about 5 miles across the pond.
Bessie Smith, recorded in 1927 as the Mississippi, the Great Flood of the Mississippi River was happening. And the United States, much of it feeling the effects. The Backwater Blues, though, as filmmaker Bill Morrison was just telling us, had actually been written for an earlier kind of precursor to the Great Flood. You said it was the Cumberland River that overflowed its
banks?
That's
what I understand, yeah.
Bill Morrison's with me on Soundcheck. His movie Dacacia was recently inducted into the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress, along with Mary Poppins and Pulp Fiction. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
The Great Flood opens tomorrow, Wednesday, January 8th, for 1 week at IFC Center here in New York. And as with Dacacia and so many of your other works, Bill, it is based on old silent footage stock. Now, in the case of Dacacia, it was a kind of fantasy on decay. What was the condition of the footage that you used for this movie, for The Great Flood?
I mean, it varied greatly, but there are some of those pock marks and the marks of humidity, essentially, that sort of affecting the nitrate, and it's decomposing and interacting with the music in much the same way. So, every frame is different. It's flecked by a different permutation, and that that interacts with the music differently.
So most filmmakers would look at this stock and say, I can't use it. It's got these pockmarks and flecks and, you know, the nitrates decaying and stuff. It's unusable. But for you...
It's gold.
Why is that?
Well, of course, it goes back to the inspiration of music, and music is a central topic to all my films, and especially in this one where it's literally the content. And I think that, again, this is making a formal representation of music in the way that it's the frames disintegrating and the images and the material of the film are becoming one, and it's making different rhythms than you'd see normally with just a clean film.
So did this archival footage, was it mostly newsreel stuff, documentary material, stuff like that?
Yeah, it was almost entirely newsreel stuff. We did create a couple different sequences. One, a virtual flyover of the valley where you see basically it looks like Lake Michigan in the middle of
the Mississippi River. Now, you have in the past cut another film to pre-existing music by Bill Frisell. How did this collaboration work?
I mean, in the past, we've done two shorts, the film of her in the mid-90s and The Mesmerist in 2003. And in both those cases, I took pre-recorded tracks of Bill's. And with The Mesmerist, we always had the idea that he would come back and record over that, but it worked so well, he threw up his hands and said, can we just play it this way? So it had always been a promise we made to one another that we would start a project from the ground up and that it would be a large project. So we were hunting for a topic that could hold that. And I was in a dinner party not long after Katrina in Baton Rouge, and they started talking about this book, Rising Tides, and how, you know, the correlations between Katrina and the 1927 flood. And I realized almost immediately that this could be a subject that Bill and I could collaborate on, just because the repercussions and the implications for music were there, his interest in Americana.
So again, the idea that this was a, you know, no pun intended, a watershed moment for American music, the flood and what it did to augment the ongoing Great Migration, as it's known. So there's one piece that Bill wrote. It's called Dynamiting Poitras, April 29th, 1927. What does Dynamiting Poitras refer to?
You know, this was essentially a bid to save New Orleans, you know, to take out a curve in the Mississippi that would flood essentially where African Americans lived, in a bid to save more wealthy white New Orleans. And so it was done, you know, people were paid pennies on the dollar for their land and forced out. So it was in some ways the most grotesque example of the disparity between rich and poor that comes out in unfortunately in events like this.
Was it successful?
Well, it was successful in that it drained the river there. It wasn't necessary in that the levees broke the night before anyway, and so that body of water never made it there, and it was completely unnecessary. So it was often referred to during Katrina because it was a willful breach of the levee.
This is some of Bill Frisell's music for Bill Morrison's otherwise silent film called The Great Flood. We'll guitarist Bill Frisell and some of his music to Bill Morrison's otherwise silent movie, The Great Flood, a movie built on archival footage of the Mississippi River flood of 1927. Bill Morrison's The Great Flood opens tomorrow, January 8th, for 1 week at the IFC Center here in New York. It'll be out on DVD and available on video on demand later this year. That piece is called Dynamiting Poitras, April 29th, 1927. There's footage of people in their Sunday best, you know, and there's a lot of dancing and stuff, obviously to music we don't hear. The subject was just made for the blues, but it seems like there was joy and life and dancing going on even in the thick of this.
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember about a flood and something I didn't really fully comprehend until I experienced the flooding of the Mississippi in 2011 and then, of course, our own flood here last year in Sandy, is that it's sort of insidious. It's creeping, you know, and life goes on with the knowledge that this thing is coming, but without the big explosion of, say, an earthquake or a fire or something.
So it's not a wall of water suddenly wiping a town away, although that can happen.
That can happen with a levee break for sure, and that's what people are fearing. But before and after that, there's a lot of hand-wringing. Mm. And with that, also some humor, and as people try to get by and endure.
Bill Morrison is with us on Soundcheck, and we're looking at the musical impact of the Great Flood. The great bluesman Charlie Patton famously recorded a two-part song about the flood, right?
That's right. High water everywhere.
Let's hear a little bit of part two.
Oh, water rising, and it's digging down. In the water was rising, applets all around.
Water's all around.
It was 50 minutes till I saw the thing and drowned.
Charlie Patton and High Water Everywhere. And about 80 years later, Bob Dylan wrote this musical response to that song.
High water rising, rising night and day. All the gold and silver I've been storing away. Picture Turner looking east and west from the dark room of his mind. He made your Kansas City, 12th Street and Vine. Nothing standing there. I want to hear the wind. Shacks are sliding down. Folks lose their possessions. The folks are leaving town. Bertha Mason shook it, broke it. Then she hung it on the wall. Say you're dancing with whom they tell you to. Well, you don't dance at all. It's tough out there. I won't I ever wear.
Bob Dylan. The song's called High Water for Charlie Patton. And we heard a little bit of Charlie Patton's High Water Everywhere, written in the aftermath of the Great Flood of 1927. And Bill, so here we are, you know, it's over 80 years ago, and, you know, musicians are still responding to it. You as a filmmaker still responding to this event. You know, the great migration up the Mississippi to Kansas City, then to Chicago, and then on into the world. I mean, what did you learn from this project? Was there something that you found that surprised you?
You know, when we set out to make it, of course, Bill writes with musicians, and
that's Bill Frisell,
yeah,
who does the score,
and so it was very important to be with his guys, and that's how the thing would be created. And I was invited into that process in a way that I hadn't been with any of my other collaborators, and we booked a tour that went around the Mississippi and started in Memphis and then it went to Texas and then to New Orleans and really up the Mississippi, St. Louis, Vicksburg. I mean, I really use music as the skeleton of all my films, so that it is different for other people. It's what I really count on when I work with a musician. And in this way, I was able to communicate to Bill using his own recordings where I saw the arc even if I had to repeat a piece in a draft version, where I saw the emotional arc of the film going, and then he was able to rewrite that, and I was able to re-edit that, and then through the entire year and a half of recording live performances, again, re-edit to the version we have now. So creatively, it was quite a process and one that I learned a lot from. And, of course, I learned all about the 1927 flood, which I only had an inkling of before. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it has inspired so much music over the years, more than we've even had time to talk about here. And the latest salvo is from Bill Frisell, his score to Bill Morrison's film The Great Flood. We'll hear a little bit more of that. The Great Flood opens tomorrow for 1 week at IFC Center here in New York. Later this year, video on demand and DVD. And Bill, it's beautiful. It's a great story and a surprising one. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much, John, and thanks for having me on the air.
Tomorrow on Soundcheck, well, you know how at the end of last year we spent all this time talking about the best music of 2013? Well, we're going to look at it from a different angle tomorrow. Race and the pop charts. Did you know, for example, that throughout all of 2013, there were no black artists in the top spot of the Billboard Hot 100? And in fact, white artists even topped the R&B chart more often than not. Join us tomorrow for our look at race and the pop charts. Plus, Benin-born, Brooklyn-based singer Angelique Kidjo, one of the great voices in world music, tells us about her new memoir and performs live. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.